Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture and discussion presented by Boston University's College of General Studies titled Famine and Socialism, Exploring the Cases of China and the Soviet Union. Speaking will be Harvard University visiting scholar Dr. Felix Weimhuer. The discussion is moderated by Social Science Associate Professor Shelley Hawks. Introducing Dr. Weimhuer is Professor Jay Corin, Division of Social Science Chair in the College of General Studies.
It's my pleasure to introduce Professor Felix Weimhuer, who's currently a visiting scholar at the Fairbanks Center for Chinese Studies at Harvard University, and he is also an assistant professor at Vienna University. He received his MA, master's degree in the politics of East Asia from Ruhr University of Bochum, Germany. And from 2000 to 2002, he studied at the Institute for CCP History, Chinese Communist Party history, that is, at the People's University of China in Beijing. During this time, he carried out field studies in Henan villages regarding the Great Leap Forward. He received his PhD from the University of Vienna in 2006, and he has published two monographs in German on intellectual and peasant memory of the Great Leap Forward in China. His current research at Harvard is entitled The Politicization of Hunger, Discourses of Food and State Peasant Relationships in Socialist China and the Soviet Union. In 2009, the conference volume New Perspectives on the Great Leap Forward and the Famine, edited together with Kimberly Manning, will be published by the University Press of British Columbia. A second conference volume, Hunger, Nutrition, and Rationing Under State Socialism, is accepted for publication at the University Press of Leipzig. Let's give Professor Weimhuer a warm welcome.
Yes, thank you, and also thank you for the invitation to speak here at BU. There's a kind of lack of comparative research regarding the Soviet and the Chinese famine, right? There were several famines in the Soviet Union after the Civil War, then in the early 30s, and one other after the Second World War in 47. And in China, there was, under communist rule, mainly this major famine during the Great Leap Forward between 59 and 61. And it's kind of obviously that on a socialist system, several famines occurred, but somehow there's a lack of comparative research. There's just a few scholars have worked on this topic. And there are several general histories and theories of famine, but it's very interesting that the socialist cases play no central role. You might know Amartya Sen, the Harvard professor who mainly worked on famines in India and also in Africa. So and I think it's surprising that socialist cases play no important role because over 80% of all famine deaths during the 20th century occurred in China and the Soviet Union. First, I'd like to start to give you some impression of the historical background. So Russia and China both can be called lands of famines. And there was one terrible famine under the Tsarist regime in 1891. There about 500,000 people died. And it was not before the 1960s, before hunger as a phenomena of everyday life disappeared. So you can maybe look at this period of history of kind of hungry years. In China, there were terrible famines in the late Qing dynasty, the last Chinese dynasty. In the late 19th century, 20 million to 30 million people died. And in China, kind of hunger as a phenomenon of everyday life has only disappeared in the 80s of the 20th century. So also we have a kind of hungry 100 years. Both countries had also different tradition in dealing with famine. So there's some new research on the Qing dynasty, and the scholars claim that the Qing dynasty had the most elaborated system of granaries and famine relief in world history without any comparison. So according to Chinese Confucianist tradition, the emperor has the responsibility to feed people in case of famine, and also the responsibility to prevent famine. However, after the Opium War in the 19th century, this kind of relief system broke down and then disappeared in the early 20th century. Compared to China, Russia had never this kind of strong tradition of famine relief, but also the Tsarist regime tried to build up a granary system in the early 19th century, but it was not so elaborated like in China. Then the First World War changed a lot, because during the First World War, many capitalist European countries introduced a kind of state economy and also rationing a system to rationize food for the army and for urban citizens. So that really kind of the state took over the direct role of kind of the food economy. Compared to Europe, so in China during the First and the Second World War, this kind of state economy and state rationing of food was never introduced. The Kuomintang government in the Civil War and also in the war against Japan only issued rationing cards to some state employees, but never to the whole population. Yeah, I want to compare mainly two famines today. So one is the Soviet famine. You already might have learned something about it from 31 to 33. I also can later talk about it, why I call it the Soviet famine and not just only the Ukrainian famine. And I like to compare it with the Great Leap Forward famine between 59 and 61. So according to different estimations, during the Soviet famine, 9 to 8 million people died. And there also, so in the internet, you also can find numbers of 15 million, but it's not no support in the academic field for this kind of figures. And during the Chinese famine, 15 to 45 million people died. There are ongoing debates for a long time. So I want to look at these particular two famines and also focus on relations between the state and the peasantry. Both famines were related to kind of great leaps. So in the Soviet Union, it was Stalin's first 4-year plan and this kind of radical program for the development of heavy industry, a kind of jump into modernity. And in China, it was a great leap forward. Both of these great leaps were kind of also very radical social revolutions in the society. Both famines are also related to the establishment of collective agriculture. In Soviet Union, the kolkhoz system was introduced in 1928, and in China in 1958, the people's communes were founded. The first years, this new forms of agriculture produced good harvests, which resulted in very unrealistic estimation and plans. When you look at the research, there are often several reasons mentioned why this famines happened. So this priority of heavy industry, very high procurement rates in the countryside, so the state transferred a lot of food from the countryside to the urban population, unrealistic plans, exports. Both countries exported food during the famine, but I also have to say, during the peak of the famine, they also reduced the exports. And in both famines, also the bad weather played a role. It was not the major reason, but it should be acknowledged. I also choose these two famines to compare because they took place during peacetime. There was already one famine in Russia, right, in the early 20s, but this was also related to the Civil War. And both governments also did not acknowledge the famine at the time, and both also rejected foreign aid. Yeah, now I want to look at the preconditions of both countries. Russia and China, also true for the whole Soviet Union, had a very unstable agricultural production and huge regional differences between surplus and non-surplus areas. And in both countries, somehow the state had to balance this huge ups and downs in the production and also these regional differences. I just want to give you the example. The Soviet Union had only one good harvest between 1927 and 1933. But it has to be said that the Soviet Union was much more developed and richer than China, so the production output in the Soviet Union in 1928 was almost double than in China in 1958. So China was one of the poorest countries in the world in the 1950s, and when you look at calorie intake and production, so they were very close to famine catastrophe before the Great Leap Forward. So against this background, it's clear that when a government make maybe just one serious mistakes with planning, then it would be result into a catastrophe. The Soviet Union had another big advantage. They had a huge livestock, and before you starve to death, you will maybe slaughter your cattle and eat it. That's kind of one anecdote. That the Soviet Union had the largest camel population in the world before the famine, and then it disappeared during the famine. And a colleague of mine asked an old Russian woman what she could remember about the famine, and she said, "Oh, I still remember this camel meat. It tastes so worse." So it's kind of not forgotten. I want to show you that not only communist system produced famine, but also famines and hunger produced revolutions. So in both countries, the breakdown of the old regime was linked to huge food supply problems in the army, right, like the Tsarist army in the last year of the First World War and the Kuomintang army during the Civil War. We can argue that the Soviet Union was even born out of famine. A very popular Bolshevist slogan during the October Revolution was bread, land, and peace. The Communist Party of China even promised the Chinese people to end hunger. One popular slogan was at that time, Gong Shan Dang Bu Hui Rang Er Si Yi Ren, the Communist Party with let nobody starve to death. In both countries, the governments presented socialism as a radical program to escape the famine, the cycle of famine and poverty. There's another similarity. In Russia in the 20s, we had this moderate economic policy, the new economic policies, and also in China in the mid-50s, the party enforced a more moderate policy of collective agriculture. According to the evaluation of government, this moderate agriculture did not produce satisfying results. For example, the procurement plans could not be fulfilled. Peasants refused to sell grain to the state. There was a kind of threat of an urban food shortage. And for them, both kind of great leaps were kind of reaction to crisis of the more moderate agriculture policies. For a long time, Western scholars also believed that the Chinese Revolution was a rural revolution and that the Chinese way of socialism was somehow more peasant-friendly than the Russian one. But when we look on it again today, it's clear that both regimes depended on the exploitation of the peasantry for industrialization. So the state forced the peasant to sell the grain on very cheap prices as the state could nourish all this increasing urban population. And both parties in the propaganda emphasized the necessity of saving every day. In China, they even had the slogan, Chao Chi Dian Guo, eat less to build up the country. There was a kind of structural conflict between peasants and state in the system. The most important question for both the peasant and the state was how much grain will remain in the villages or how much grain also could the state take to feed the urban population. As already said, the prices for grain were quite low, and peasants had an interest in understating the production results and exaggerating damage by natural disaster. So, of course, the government was quite aware of this problem. Mao Zedong said in 59 that the Chinese peasant might hide 15% of the grain production. So the action of the state could be to estimate real figures and set up the plans. As I already said, they were both poor countries, so wrong estimations could be reside in catastrophes. The state made the promise to end famine, but at the other hand, the state was also afraid that peasants could instrumentalize hunger against the state and also exaggerate the results of a natural disaster. Somehow the state reacted against this form of peasant resistance with kind of moralizing the tribute to the state. So you should hand over the grain, you should sell the grain to the state in order to build up the country. We need it for industrialization, to feed the army, and so on. In Tibet in 59, they even introduced the so-called patriotic grain tax, Igor Liang, right? And if you don't pay the tax, you're not a patriot. The message is very clear. But the peasants could also react to this kind of strategy, that they would moralize hunger and remind the state of a promise to abolish hunger. And this was quite a strong argument. So it was hard to say or difficult to say, yeah, I like private agriculture and market economy, then maybe you would just get arrested. But when you would say, oh, I'm hungry, that would create some pressure for the government to act. So Stalin reacted with a new law in 32 that stealing of socialist property could be punished with a death penalty. This also included the stealing of grain from the kolkhoz. There was no such law in China, but the local cadres often used violent means to stop stealing. Both governments also started campaigns to find a hidden grain, right? They said, oh, when peasants complain they're hungry, this might not be true. Maybe they had just the grain somewhere in their houses. The Soviet Union also reacted with mass deportations of the peasantry. This is not the case in China. For a long time, people are asking the question why there were no peasant uprisings in China. But the same is also true for the Ukraine and the Soviet Union. We have peasant uprisings in 28 and early 30 against the collectivization, huge peasant uprising, but there are no major peasant uprisings in the Ukraine in 33 during the peak of the famine, and there are also no major peasant uprisings in China during the peak of the famine. And this might be strange, but when we look at other cases, often when people are starving and close to death, they have no energy to organize any uprising. And also during the Irish famine in the 19th century, many unrest took place before and after the peak of the famine, but not during the peak of mass starvation. So I heard you already heard the theory that a kind of Stalin might have used the famine for political reason and organized it on purpose. Maybe I can later talk more about it. One similarity is also between China and the Soviet Union is that the government protected the major cities and industries during the famine. So you just have a certain amount of food, and then the government, they made their priorities. So in China, Beijing, Shanghai, and Tianjin, and also provincial capitals, were kind of well protected. People still would receive rations. There are many people were hungry, some went sick, but there was no mass starvation to death in these places. And in China, in the Soviet Union, the Soviet government protected important cities like Moscow, Leningrad, or the Donetsk region in the Ukraine. Then there was, of course, also a hierarchy of hunger in the society. So party cadres, army members and their families, workers in important industry and also intellectuals, they had a privilege and were usually not starving to death. And it's also quite of interesting that the government tried to limit rural migration to the cities. And the Soviet Union introduced the internal passport in 1932. This was mainly to clean up the cities from unwanted groups. And in China, the internal passport was already introduced before the famine in 1958. Without a permit or without a legal status in the cities, you could not get any access to food. And maybe there were some black markets, but you could not get a kind of legal access to food. I would argue here, in this context, that during the famine, this kind of internal passport and control of rural migration to the cities were very ineffective. So I just maybe want to show you a few numbers. So before the introduction of the passport system, the urban population in the Soviet Union increased from 26 million to 40 million between 27 and 32. And then even after the internal passport was introduced, the surplus of arrivals over departures in the cities was between 2 and 3 million. In China, the figures are even more impressive. So the urban population increased over 19.5 million between 57 and 60. So in both cases, there is kind of an urbanization without any comparison in history in such a short time. So many people went to the cities, and the state had to feed them more or less. I talked a lot about the similarities between China and the Soviet Union, but there, of course, were also some differences. So in China, the cities were much better protected than the Soviet Union. So in the Soviet Union, there were also high death rates in towns and less important as provincial cities. This is an interesting fact, right? We said the Chinese Revolution was a rural revolution, but during the famine, the Chinese Communist Party even protected the cities better. The Soviet Union had a very bad experience with the interaction of rural and urban famine in the early 20s. So we first had this urban famine in the last year of the First World War and then during the October Revolution, and then in 1920 it turned into a rural famine in the south of Russia, and then into an urban famine again. So I would also argue in both cases the governments were quite afraid that the rural famines would turn into an urban famine, and their policies, where the top priority of their policies was to prevent that the rural famine would turn into urban famine. In Russia, the Bolshevik Party also had this experience of the Khrushchev rising in 21, when loyal parts of the army and workers turned against Bolshevik rule. And I think the parties in both countries considered the protection of the city as essential for the survival of the regimes. But this urban bias is also no characteristic of socialist system. I just want to give you one example here. There was this terrible famine in Bengal. It's Bangladesh today in 1942-43. It was under British rule. And in Calcutta, the important warnistry was based, so the British government issued rationing cards in Calcutta to protect the industry, and 2 to 3 million people died in the countryside. So I think that many modern regimes somehow considered kind of the cities as the key to survive. Yeah, now I want to talk about the time after the famine. So Alexander De Waal made the argument in the case of Africa that it would be very important that government establish an anti-famine contract with the population after the famine. This don't have to be a formal contract. It's more kind of informal agreement. We should do everything that it never happened again. So I already said the Soviet and the Chinese government did not acknowledge the famine, so there could be no kind of open or formal anti-famine contract. But I would argue that there are some evidence that they learned something from it, and The Soviet case is a little bit more complicated because we have another famine in 47, but after 47, no famine occurred in the Soviet Union, and in China, no famine occurred after 62. So how could they prevent famine? The countries were also still very poor after it. So both countries established a mixed economy with hybrid ownership structures in the countryside in the aftermath of the famine. There was also in the agriculture collectives. You had also private plots, some form of markets, collective economy. The state was also involved. It was very different version of collective agriculture than during the early Great Leaps, where the government tried to socialize everything and abolished private property at all. The state had to acknowledge the limits to exploit the peasants. So after the famine, the procurement rates were never high again, and this status quo was never challenged. Nor Stalin, neither Mao Zedong launched any kind of a new, very radical policies in the countryside. Yeah, in China, they start to import grain from 62. My argument would be mainly to feed the cities, but then they could sort of reduce the burden for the peasants. And the taxation of peasants in China after 62 was quite moderate compared to the 50s and compared to the Great Leap Forward, also during the Cultural Revolution, and it was a kind of a stable policy. In the Soviet Union, they introduced social welfare to the peasants in late Khrushchev years, and then especially during the Brezhnev eras in the 70s, that peasants would have the right to receive pensions, paid holidays. They try to construct a rural industry and rural healthcare system, and so on. And in the Soviet Union, they started to subsidize agriculture from the late 60s on. So we have a kind of radical shift in policies from exploitation of the peasants, which resulted in famine, to a huge subsidizing of agriculture, which in the end was a huge burden for the Soviet state budget. Of course, we know China is a very big country and was even poorer, so they never introduced such kind of subsidies for agricultural products, even to these days. But, however, Mao Zedong launched an important campaign during the Cultural Revolution. It was called Prepare for War, Prepare for Famine for the People, Bei Jianbei, Huang Wei Renmin. And in this campaign, the local authorities were encouraged to build up local granaries and local grain reserves. So, of course, there was no reference made to the Great Leap Forward. The argument was the Soviet Union might attack us, and therefore we need this kind of local grain reserves that also the local places and the provinces could start a guerrilla warfare against the Soviet in invasion, but nevertheless they were much better prepared for famine then. And now let me come to the conclusion. I hope you have many questions, and I can go more into details in the topics you are interested in. So in Russia and China, the rise of communism was linked to the experience of hunger. After the revolution, the regimes launched radical campaigns to escape from famine, but even produced more serious famine than in the past. Both Great Leap famines could be understood against the background of the conflict between state and the peasantry. The famines were a deadly escalation of the struggle over the agricultural surplus. The Soviet interest Chinese communists decided to protect the urban population, which caused even higher death rates in the rural areas. In the end, the state had to acknowledge the limits to exploit the peasants and introduce a mixed economy in the countryside. In later decades of socialist rule in both countries succeeded to break out a cycle of famine. So the history of socialism could be rewritten as a history of dealing with hunger, and this is exactly what I'm doing now in my book. And I like to end the talk about this kind of very heavy topic with a more happy picture. This is a wedding in Henan, in a village after the corn harvest. So I hope you have many questions now here.
question. I'm going to pass the mic to you.
I had a question about how these hardships that they've been through, how that influenced the Chinese mentality, the Russian mentality. Since you spent time in China, what did you notice?
Yeah, that is an interesting question. I did research on this, how people remember the famine, and when you go to a village in Henan, Anhui, or Sichuan province and talk to old people, they all can tell you in detail about the famine, and they can remember how the corpses were lying on the street and how everybody was stealing to survive. So on their life, it had a deep impact, and deeper impact than I think than the Cultural Revolution. The Cultural Revolution was mainly an urban movement, and often for these peasants, kind of the most painful experience was a famine. It was also painful because many supported the Communist Party during the land reform, and also many poor peasants told me they were very thankful that the Communist Party gave the land of the landlords to them. But a lot of them, they lost the kind of hope and belief in the system during the famine. And the author Ralph Saxon from Brandeis University, he made the argument that the Communist Party never recovered from this crisis, from this legitimacy crisis in the countryside. So, and he goes further, he said, why does the Chinese peasants do not accept the one-child policy and do still have two or three children? He makes the argument is because so many peasants lost children during the famine, so they think maybe if ever kind of catastrophe has happened again, it's better than to have one. And he also made the argument is a lot of anti-tax riots were also related to the famine experience because peasants made the experience in the past that the state could set the tax so high that people would starve. But I maybe just from my own experience will tell you an anecdote. When you ever go on a train to China, maybe just say from Beijing to Xi'an, 12 hours, and look what the Chinese are bringing on the train. They often have food for 4 or 5 days. So, and often they are young people, so I think a lot of Chinese still like to store things. And sometimes the peasants, when you go to peasants, they have a kind of corn or grain in their houses enough to eat for 2 years. So there's still this, even if it's not a kind of, people maybe not might think about it, but there's still a kind of a culture of, it's better, somehow it's better to prepare for something, right?
I'm interested in the comparison of the Chinese and Soviet cases to what happened in Cambodia. So also a socialist regime, also great famine. You know, millions of people died in Cambodia under the Pol Pot regime. And productivity was not restored to Cambodian agriculture until after the Vietnamese restored private property, redistributed land into private property. And so it really was an issue of the productivity of agriculture. And I wonder, was that also why, under these socialist regimes, a famine was even worse than before they started?
Yeah, that is also a tough question. I think the Cambodian case is also different from this famine because there was forced a kind of also the bombing of the U.S. Air Force. Then they had civil war, and then the kind of Red Khmer also started this kind of genocide. It was more kind of related to civil war and war. Why here we have two famines which really happened during peacetime, no foreign invasion, no civil war. This is a kind of big difference. And why it was worse maybe was what the Chinese peasants naturally did during famines. They just would run away to other places. People would start to beg. They would steal. The communist, or during under communist rule, the famine was very serious in places where the local authorities succeeded to suppress migration. One example, it's in the south of Henan province, Xinjiang, the very famous Xinjiang incident, Xinjiang Shijian, where 2 to 3 million people died. In this case, the local government succeeded to block migration and to that people could could run away. And maybe these traditional regimes, they also wanted that peasants would pay their tax. But now under Stalin Mao, you had this government who believe we have to enforce industrialization in this short period of time. Otherwise, we will be get crashed by imperialism. This was a kind of argument. If we don't jump into modernity in a couple of years, we will get crashed. So they were kind of much more radical in taking the grain from the countryside than the traditional regimes in China and Russia, which had no so ambitious plans.
I'm just curious, did you find any similarities in your research with how capitalist societies dealt with famine?
Yeah, it's very interesting. If you're interested in this topic, I can recommend the book of Mike Davis to you, The Late Victorian Holocaust. And this book is about the famines under British rule, so under colonialist rule in India, and also in China, right? It was not under direct British rule, and also in this late British Empire, millions of people starved to death, and during the famine, also in India, Great Britain exported then grain from India to England, and at this time, the context was very different. So they had this very strong laissez-faire, liberal market economy at that time, and they just said, whatever happens, we cannot send relief. The market should solve the problem. So there's a book about that famine. And I also made the argument that these problems with hunger and famine in this kind of pre-revolutionary regimes also contributed to the rise and the success of the socialist revolution. But I also argued that Russia and China were some countries where you had this tradition, the government should help people when there's a famine. You don't have this tradition in every society and cannot take it for granted. And, of course, there's also a book from Alexander De Waal, Famine Crimes, mainly about the famine in Africa. And he makes interesting arguments there that now a lot of governments don't take responsibility for famine anymore because they say, oh, now the NGOs, they should deal with hunger and famine. So this is Alexander De Waal, Famine Crimes, or Mike Davis, Late Victorian Holocaust.
In the Russian famine of 1933-34, you mentioned how that was mostly in the Ukraine and Northern Caucasus, and that has been used as a sort of movement for independence after the fall of the Soviet Union. Is there any provinces or areas in China that experienced drastic amounts of famine during the Great Leap Forward, more so than others, that have encouraged this sort of regional nationalism due to famine?
Yeah. So in Russia and the Soviet Union, in many places people died. The highest death toll had Kazakhstan, with a normal population much higher than the Ukraine. And then, of course, there was Kuban region in Russia and Ukraine, which was very terrible, but also many people died in Russia. And there is a kind of the big debate now, while some scholars claim it was a Soviet famine, right? Then Ukrainian nationalists say they try to make the argument, no, it was our famine, it was the Ukrainian famine. And this is a very sensitive topic in the academia, so there are some scholars claiming that this famine was organized by Stalin on purpose to harm the Ukrainian nation. I think mainly the Ukrainian diaspora, but there are also the other faction makes the argument it was not organized on purpose. I already argued that, of course, there were kind of bad government policies. So I just want to give you one example. There is a debate about the question how much grain was in the stocks. So Robert Conquest, in his book Harvest of Sorrow made the argument that there was enough grain in the stocks to feed all the people, and if Stalin wanted, he just had to open the grain stocks and there would be no famine in Ukraine, while other scholars like Stephen Wheatcroft and Mark Torger, they did research on this history development of the granary system, and they made the argument that the Soviet government failed in the 20s to build up an efficient granary system, and there was some grain in the stocks to save some of the people, but it would not be enough to save all of them. And the same could be said about the exports, right? When there would be no export, less people would have been starved, but the exports was not so much that the famine could be prevented at all. But this is a kind of very heated debate, and there are some scholars from both factions who still talk about each other, but some don't. And in Ukraine, they now made a new law that if you deny that the famine was a genocide, you can go to go to jail. So it's the same with a kind of a Holocaust law. And in Ukraine, it's very politicized. So they now have museums and memorial sites all over the countries. And scholars, if a Ukrainian scholar don't stick to the official version, have a kind of very hard lives there. But just sorry for the long explanation. You come back to your question you asked about China. So in China, the famine had no ethnical dimension. So it's interesting that Tibet, Xinjiang, the places where the minority are based, at that time, they were actually better off. So there were many Han Chinese peasants who were fleeing to Xinjiang to escape from the famine. And the provinces where the mass starvation took place, Henan, Anhui, Sichuan, were Han Chinese places. So this... the famine have no ethnical dimension in China, but I also wrote a paper about the use of hunger and Tibetan nationalism. It is also then it was also used later as an argument against the communist party. Then Tibetans in exile claimed, "Look, under Chinese rule, the Tibetans were starving. Therefore, we must be independent." So I wrote this paper about the use of famine in nationalist narratives. Another example is also the Irish famine right under British rule, where then the Irish nationalists claimed the British organized the famine on purpose to wipe out the Irish nation. They're kind of... So it's very interesting. So I'm also very interested in the question how people use history or historical arguments in politics today. Maybe it's even more important than the question what really happened.
You mentioned how both countries denied foreign aid.
Yeah.
Would you say that the failure of both countries to deal with the famine for so long was a result of the socialist system or more the leaders, the individual leaders and their motives?
Yeah, that's also a tough question. So the Soviet... I think it's not necessarily a socialist thing to deny famine relief. So there was this famine during the Civil War, and Lenin acknowledged the famine in public, and then there was Herbert Hoover and the American Relief Association then were allowed to work in Russia, and this saved the life of a million people. And also another example, the famine in North Korea in the 90s, right, there was a lot of change in the policies of the North Korean government, but for quite a long time, they also allowed foreign aid and also allowed NGOs to work in the country. So it's not necessary kind of the socialist government have to deny foreign aid. So in the 30s, right, one problem for the Soviet Union, it did not have kind of many diplomatic relations, and also China had almost no diplomatic relation to capitalist countries in the 50s. Great Britain was one exception. But in the Chinese case, they could have asked the Soviet Union for help. But at that time, it was a kind of the conflict between China and the Soviet Union already broke out. And the Soviet Union was kind of very critical of the Great Leap Forward. And somehow the Mao also wanted to keep his face, and he was not willing to ask the Soviet Union for help. So the grain exports at that time were mainly just went to the Soviet Union. And I think I made this differentiation in my talk. So I think in this early, very radical and very revolutionary period of the socialist system in Russia and China, this terrible famine occurred. But then later, I think when also government and also the peasant learned something from it, then they were successful to end famine. And there was also collective agriculture in China after 62 and also in China, in the Soviet Union in the 50s and the 60s. So it was not kind of a direct result of collective agriculture. And you can look, of course, at states like the GDR or Czechoslovakia or Poland, who were much more developed as the Soviet Union and China. And in these countries, yeah, like when the government would make some serious mistake with planning, then there may be some kind of shortage, but not a famine. Yeah. So this I also should keep in mind. So maybe when the U.S. government have a bad president or make some mistakes, then the government or state will lose money. But in this case of China, it's just a poor country at that time. When you just set the quotas 10% too high, then it could be then people could starve. So. Yeah, but I also think that the Chinese government was successful to prevent famine in the early 50s, but somehow this kind of mechanism then broke down during the Great Leap Forward. Yeah.
In looking at the Great Leap Forward, when was it that Mao finally acknowledged that there was a famine, and was it before the peak? And then why was it that something was not done about it? And then also just to get more concrete information on the exports, when were the exports of the grain stopped? And weren't they also exporting to Eastern Europe as well as Soviet Union?
Yeah, also to East Germany. Yeah, so this is an interesting question. How much did Stalin and Mao know? So according to the knowledge of today, Stalin was, I think, much better informed, and they had a kind of much better information system. And Mao got news about famine in early 59, right before the peak, then also during the peak in 60. But somehow he was unwilling to acknowledge that it was really a national problem. They said, oh, this might be some local problems and we should help the people, but they were not willing to accept the extent of the famine. But if you go on a website of Yale Agrarian Studies, there is a new paper of mine, and there I make the argument. So more traditional argument was that the increasing knowledge of the famine was the reason why the government changed the policies in 61. Yeah, this was more the traditional argument. But either makes the argument that it was the threat of an urban famine which was the reason for the change of the policies. In the granaries of Beijing and Shanghai and Tianjin, there just was grain left for a couple of days in late 60 and early 61. So they had to make the decision, okay, let's continue the Great Leap Forward, and then also people in the cities will die, or let's change the policies. And I think it was more a threat of urban famine. And I, for a long time, I also believed that the government did really nothing during the famine. But now I think that is not true. They try to curb consumption in urban and rural areas, cut rations. And there are many decisions during the peak of the famine to transform more grain out of the countryside to the cities. So they were quite aware of the situation. I think they only stopped when it was clear to them, we cannot get any more grain out of the countryside, and we have to change the policies. So the exports were reduced in 60. So both countries, as I said, reduced the exports during the famine. So they somehow acknowledged there was a problem. But then in 61, 62, China started to import massive grain also from Canada and from Hong Kong. And it's interesting. So before the famine, China could always export grain. But after the famine, after 62, for most of the years until now, they also have to import grain. So this... and Soviet Union also under Khrushchev and Brezhnev, when they had kind of more serious problems, they also imported grain from other countries. Yeah, but I think somehow they believed in the cities, there are the industry, the working class. We have to feed the army. This is the top priority, and not the people in the countryside.
What do you think is the most reliable number for the number of deaths, according to Great Leap Forward?
Yeah, so I do not do research on this topic, but the most of the scholars, they use a population survey from, I think, 82, then to make different estimations. So I said the lowest is 50 million and the highest 45 million, and depend on your... how you treat these numbers and your mathematics and your approach, what you will get out. Now, in the Chinese government officially acknowledged a population loss of 40 million, but this also includes people who were not born because of the famine, so it was more a kind of general population loss. So I think maybe it's something 30 million or something. But you can also make the argument that we might never find out because the statistic system at this time this broke down. And people also had often no interest in report deaths because you still could get the rations for the dead people, right, and eat it as long as you're not reported. So it's very hard to say. Maybe so we might never know.
Thank you very much.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've been listening to a lecture and discussion presented by Boston University's College of General Studies titled Famine and Socialism, Exploring the Cases of China and the Soviet Union. Our speaker was Harvard University visiting scholar Dr. Felix Weimhuhr. The discussion was moderated by Social Science Associate Professor Shelley Hawks. Dr. Weimhuhr was introduced by Professor Jay Corin, Division of Social Science Chair in the College of General Studies. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Ryan Peterson and Edward Mazulis. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.